Campus FM presents the 14th Annual St. Augustine Lecture 2010, entitled Augustine's Evaluation of Fear and Its Reception. This lecture is delivered by Professor Dr. Paul Van Gest.
So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Philosophy Society, I welcome you to the 14th Annual St. Augustine Lecture. Our distinguished speaker this evening is Professor Paul Van Gest, from the Faculty of Theology at the Free University of Amsterdam. Dr. Van Gest is Professor of Patristics and Augustinian Studies at Tilburg University and the Free University of Amsterdam, where he is also Director of the Center for Patristic Research. Since 2007, Professor Van Gest has given more than 100 interviews to national newspapers, Dutch radio and television, on developments in science, scholarship, and the church. But he has also published and edited 13 books and conducted postgraduate seminars at the universities of Amsterdam, Utrecht, Leuven, and Oxford. The title of Professor Van Gest's lecture this evening is The Incomprehensibility of God as Cause of Concern, Augustine of Hippo as a Negative Theologian and the Merging of Orthodoxy. Professor Van Gest.
It is a great honor and a great joy for me to deliver the annual St. Augustine Lecture for you today. Whoever is granted the privilege in his life, as I am, to be able to continue pursuing research with respect to the life and the work of St. Augustine, knows that he stands on a giant's shoulder. And when I look at the list of scholars who delivered this lecture before me, I get something of the same feeling. At the same time, I'm also happy to be here, because it indicates that a small country, which also the Netherlands is, the interest in the Church Fathers in general and Saint Augustine in particular has greatly increased during the past years at both Catholic and Protestant theological faculties. The presupposition of this lecture is that throughout his life, Augustine maintained a balance between speaking about God and remaining silent about him. On the one hand, as a priest and a bishop, he wished to prevent misunderstandings concerning the nature of God's essence and activity. The things revealed in Scripture about this subject were sacred to him. On the other hand, already as a young priest, he already showed his concern to drive home to the faithful the idea that God is a mystery. For Augustine, negation of the possibility of comprehending God stood in sharp contrast to any negation of God himself. There were even signs that Augustine was also aware quite early that unknowing was the highest form of knowledge of God. And it is here that the questions arise. Did Augustine strive to negate everything that he had been said about God in order to safeguard his mystery? Or was his main concern in dialogue and polemic to prevent misunderstandings about the nature of God's essence and activity? And was his emphasis on God's incomprehensibility and ineffability merely ornamental? The one possibility appears to exclude the other. Augustine's discourse about God has often been despised. Commentators believed it was too affirmative as to the content and too narrowly defined. And it is therefore no more than logical that Augustine's work received little attention from those modern thinkers who developed a renewed interest in the significance of religion for contemporary culture. Because dogmatic assertions abounded both in Augustine's work and in his reception, it is not difficult to understand that the possibility that he might have something to contribute to this awakening has hardly been considered. Between 408 and 418, however, Augustine delivered a sermon that was of great interest for many reasons and also for the purpose of my lecture today. It was recorded as Sermo 117. It provides evidence that there is a good reason to view Augustine as an authoritative source for post-Christian negative discourse, and his emphasis on God incomprehensibility is not merely ornamental. The sermon is remarkable because Augustine thematically discussed discourse about God in a critique on the Arians' religious views, while simultaneously introducing God's incomprehensibility. He was not the only church father who attempted to refute Arianism by referring to God's ineffability. In treatises against Arius' religious convictions, other passages from the first centuries also interwove affirmative and negative statements about God's preeminent being. But Sermo 117 not only showed how affirmative speaking about God and being silent before God could fit together, but also how even heterodoxy and orthodoxy occasionally merged. Sermo 117 is fascinating because Augustine's dismantling of what he believed to be an erroneous conception of God went hand in hand with a number of qualifications that put his own statements into perspective. He challenged heresy and yet, paradoxically, emphasized God's incomprehensibility. In this sermon, he gave voice even to the reticence or uncertainty that resulted from this incomprehensibility. It is difficult to reconstruct the theology of the Alexandrian priest Arius. We may assume that he emphasized the unique divinity of the Father. The Son's divinity was derived from this because the Father created the Son. And by arguing thus, Arius was advocating a form of monotheism. There was an immutable and absolute transcendent God who not only transcended the created world, but also surpassed the mutable Son and the Holy Spirit. As a result, in particular of the influence of Athanasius, the Council of Nicaea in 325 condemned this theology, which was ascribed to Arius. The fathers of the council held on to belief in the triune God. They rejected the view that the Son's nature was subordinate to the Father's. Now, let us return to Sermo 117. It is a sermon on the first part of the prologue of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He explained, Augustine explained simply that it was impossible in the beginning of this sermon to try and find the meaning of this sentence, because it would be to seek a thing that was both incomprehensible and ineffable. Augustine then asked what it was that prevented human beings from understanding this passage. And in his first reflection, which lasted until a later part of the sermon, Augustine discussed God's ineffability. And in the end of the sermon, he linked God's ineffability with God's incomprehensibility. It is, therefore, not probable that Augustine's primary concern in this sermon was to confound heresy. If that had been the case, he would have chosen his introduction very, very badly. After all, he emphasized the impossibility of grasping the word in human words. In fact, Augustine had something else in mind. He tried to lead those who were primarily interested in demonstrating their scientific skill as an aim in itself to the virtue of humility. Therefore, I like this sermon as a scholar. He reproached them for not realizing that they could only think within the confines of space and time. And Augustine remarked that the key to reading John 1:1-3 was that the text was not written to be understood, but to confront human beings with their incapacity to understand. He suggested that this view on human limitedness led human beings to experience unknowing as an overture to a further quest for God, but this time carried out with the necessary humility and the understanding of one's own limitations would bring about a yearning for a right understanding of the word. A first impediment to a specific understanding of the word was connected to the word's incomprehensible character. The word, the logos, gave form, forma, to everything created within well-defined limits on earth. But in a fundamental contrast to everything that was created, the word itself was not formed in space and time. It was forma infabricata, immutable, limitless, and without defects. The word embraced everything in time and space. The word did not have form as every other word did. It was not a word in the human understanding of words, and that is why it could not be understood as a lesser part of the whole. Just as an arm took up less space than the whole body in the dimension of space. This explanation already hinted at a criticism of Arianism, which Augustine would develop subsequently. According to him, Arians regarded God too much in terms of time and space. And that is why it is impossible for them to see the Son as a part of the triune God, as great as the whole. However, Augustine deftly moved beyond this almost implicit criticism. Equally implicit was his accusation that the Arians, with their concrete notion of God, indulged in pride, as if believing that knowledge of God gave them power. This comment amounted to little, however, in comparison with his more powerfully formulated conviction that it was absolutely impossible for human beings to comprehendere the whole of God truly and without doubt. If you grasp it, Augustine says, it is not God. Si comprehendis, non est Deus. In Augustine's view, it was only possible for a human being to mentally attain to, attingere, contingere, God with a pure inner eye and a life that was properly ordered. But even such pure persons subsequently realized how distant they were from God, he writes. We must not form images of spiritual realities in materialistic terms. The word that God is not less in his parts than in his totality. But you are quite unable to imagine or think of such a thing. And such ignorance, he writes, is more religious and devout than any presumption of knowledge. After all, we are talking about God. It says, and the Word was God, John 1:1. We are talking about God, so why be surprised if you cannot grasp it? I mean, if you can grasp it, it is not God. So let us make a devout confession of ignorance instead of a brash profession of knowledge. To grasp God, to comprehend God, is altogether impossible. So in this quotation, Augustine linked the idea of God's ineffability and incomprehensibility with a reflection on the limited possibilities of human understanding. He spoke with an apophatic, negative tone that he maintained throughout Sermo 117, even when discussing the dogmatic differences between Catholic and Arian Christians. In fact, this tone quite dominated his refutation of Arianism. And then there's a second part in this sermon. In the second part of this sermon, Augustine criticized the Arian conviction that the Father was greater than the Son and that the Father preceded the Son in time. He emphasized once more that it was wrong to apply material concepts to spiritual concepts. He denied that the natural event in which parents preceded their children did not adequately conceptualize the spiritual processions in God. Augustine therefore stated frankly and apparently desperately that he would prefer simply to be silent before God, to remain silent about God. He did not do this, however, because readers might then have thought either that there was nothing to say about God, or that Augustine was at a loss for an answer. And these arguments masked the real reason. In light of his previous words on the limitations of human cognitive power, Augustine primarily and with rhetorical pathos emphasized the ineffability of God. And he says, then what are we to do? Shall we keep silent? Oh, if only we were free to. Because then perhaps by keeping quiet we could think some thoughts worthy of the unutterable. Anything that can be uttered, of course, is not unutterable. But God is unutterable. And so, brothers and sisters, it would have been better if he could keep silent and say, this is a matter of faith, this is what we believe, you cannot grasp it, you are a parvulus, a little one. Here, Augustine takes the term silence almost as a terminus technicus, as a term expressing that one is unable to express a certain reality. So with respect to God, silence implies that God neither has a correlate in reality, nor refers to and corresponds with something or someone in time and space. Moreover, Augustine, like the Neoplatonist Porphyry, here connects silence with the theological discourse. In almost the same words as Porphyry, who was to turn against the Christians at a later stage of his life, he says that he would rather be silent about God than hold a discourse about God. And from Plotinus himself, amongst others, Augustine borrowed the idea that the highest truth of God could not be adapted to the inferior vessel of language. Nowhere did Augustine express this insight more pithily and more despairingly than in this quotation. After uttering his unfulfilled wish to secure ineffability of God's exaltedness, he once more emphasized the efficiency of human mind. The essence of God could not be expressed or thought by human beings at all. And he says, we must, of course, safeguard that the ineffableness, the unutterable quality of the divine greatness, and nobody should suppose, when we offer some comparisons in arguing with the Arians, that we have already attained to what can be neither uttered nor thought by the parvuli, the little ones. Augustine therefore gave many and exhaustive apophatic disclaimers. He continued to emphasize the incompleteness of the knowledge that fell to human beings on earth, and with it, God's inscrutability for the created order. Only as soon as he had justified his emphasis on the necessity of silence, did he turn to Arian teaching. It is important to note that he insisted on this particular sequence. The expression of his desire to remain silent was no ornamental or perfunctory command to mitigate the confidence of some assertion. Now, in his early years, Augustine criticized anthropomorphic conceptions of God in North African and Catholic popular culture. In his first commentary on Genesis, he displayed a horror of images of God that literally ascribed physical characteristics of human qualities to him. This horror was rooted in a conviction that such images failed to safeguard the mystery of God and turned God into a concrete and tangible object. In Sermo 117, he formulated his critique of Arianism. And this critique is essentially similar to that which underlay his arguments against the anthropomorphical culture in North Africa. The Arians contended that God had to precede the sun in time, The sum could not therefore be equal to the Father. And according to Augustine, this approach did not do justice to the incomprehensibility and ineffability of the mystery of God. Augustine stressed that the Arians thought too much in terms of natural relationships on earth. They made use of an all too human conception of matter, and consequently offended against the incomprehensibility and ineffability of God's mystery in the same way as those who ascribed to God bodily characteristics and human qualities. In this part too, Augustine anticipated the idea that if the image of God was limited to something that could be perceived with the senses or conceived of by the mind, and thus was reduced to human measure, it became a lifeless image of God because it lacked any capacity to signify, to refer to a thing beyond itself. The invisible, the incomprehensible, was caught in a recognizable representation, which impeded a true and authentic experience of the divine. Augustine was very conscious of this problem. So, for him, there was no way of saying anything that could do justice to the unity of Father and Son. And in this way, Augustine created an apophatic framework for his own orthodox rendering of the relation between Father and Son. Affirmative discourse was embedded in negative discourse about God. It was not the reverse in Sermo 117. So Augustine opposed the Arian view that the Father was prior to the Son. He thought that this belief gave up an element of the mystery of God. His apophatic discourse allowed him to acknowledge that the Arian comparison of the bond between the Father and the Son with the natural bond between a father and son better reflected the idea that they were one regarding their nature. Orthodox thinking in particular guaranteed the co-eternity and equality of the Son with the Father. But Augustine accepted that Arianism explained their unity of nature as well, and he praises the Arians for that. Arianism had something to offer when the unity in nature of the Father and the Son had to be explained. He nonetheless immediately recommended disengagement from earthly reality or analogies. In Sermo 117, he also defended the view that human beings could have a certain perception of this equality in eternity and of this immutability in their minds. But an apophatic consciousness was evident again in all of his reflections, and this formed a first step towards the integration of humility as a way of living. He says, "Above all, however, never forget this. Whatever we have been able to gather from creatures, whether through the body's senses or the mind's reflections, is inexpressibly surpassed by the Creator. But do you want to brush against him with your mind? Purify your mind. Purify your heart. Because blessed are the clean of heart, since they shall see God. Consequently, when Augustine thematically discussed the knowability of God, he was more apophatic than the reception of his work would suggest. As a hammer of heretics, he even made it impossible for himself to dispute their opinions. The confounding of heretics, however, did not appear to have been his aim. Importantly, he emphasized that notwithstanding God's incomprehensibility, human beings could achieve an incomplete, more intuitive notion of God if they had the correct inner disposition. And then, in Psalm 117, the question arose as to how human beings could approach God contingere if it was impossible to comprehendere him. Augustine attempted to answer this question at the end of Sermo 117. His emphasis was once again on God's incomprehensibility. But there's also another aspect. In Johannes Evangelium Tractatus, Augustine had already advanced the notion that a preacher should quickly disabuse his audience of the conviction that God and Christ were incomprehensible. Not to do this would be to deprive them, the powerfully, of the awareness that Christ was important to humankind as a doctor, as a medicus. And in De Trinitate, Augustine elaborated on this line of thought. As long as the believer was not yet capable of taking solid food, he was nourished by milk, by belief, not by knowing. As long as the mind was not pure enough to see the ineffable, human beings had to look up to the crucified. In him, they could form an image of God. And in the end of Sermo 117, Augustine reiterated this idea, entirely in line with the views already expressed. He outlined the implications of the incarnation. If human beings were incapable of grasping the incarnate word in a divine form, then they must listen to the word in a human form. Augustine regularly interrelated these perspectives with each other. And in Sermo 117, he started from the idea that in Christ, God himself had come into human life and had addressed humanity. He says, "Beloved, we are children of God, and it had not yet appeared, and it has not yet appeared what we shall be. We know that when he appears, we shall be like him, since we shall see him as he is. That is what we are promised. But in order to get there, if we cannot yet see the word of God, let us listen, if we cannot see the word as God, let us listen to the word as flesh. Let us listen to the word who became flesh." And of course, Augustine hastened to add that the word immutably remained itself. Being one in essence with the Father, it did not change its nature. But the Word became interwoven in some way with humanity. And following the advice that was, according to Augustine, embodied in the Incarnation, would bring about the highest level of receptivity to its mystery. And this advice was to be humble and meek as Christ was. So for Augustine, the awareness of God's exaltedness, incomprehensibility and ineffability thus was the path to insight into the nature of God. But he realized that human beings could only travel along that road when they had mastered the basic attitude of humility, which was the mainspring of the incarnation and the medicine of the medicus humilis, Christ the humble doctor. And only by accepting this basic attitude could human beings be certain of experiencing peace. Come to me, Augustine writes, and he quotes Matthew, all you who toil and are overburdened, and I will refresh you. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, because I am meek and humble of heart. So, Sermo 117 thus clearly delineated the boundaries between orthodoxy and heterodoxy. But it also showed appreciation for heterodox discourse about God. This sermon even regarded heterodox discourse about certain aspects of the Trinity as more enlightening than the orthodox treatment of it. So let us suppose that a prefect of the Roman Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith discovered this sermon. We might well ask what his response would be. This situation has never occurred to the present day, and we can only surmise at an answer to our question. We do know, however, what the response was of a former prefect who was elected pope. In his first encyclical letter, Deus Caritas Est, Pope Benedict XVI showed his familiarity with the essence of Sermo 117. He quoted the sermon's short and central phrase, Si comprehendis non est Deus, with approval. Nor did he leave it at that. He says, it is Saint Augustine who gives us faith's answer to our sufferings. Si comprehendis non est Deus. If you understand him, he's not God. Even in their bewilderment and failure to understand the world around them, Christians continue to believe in the goodness and loving kindness of God. Immersed like everyone else in the dramatic complexity of historical events, they remain unshakably certain that God is our Father, and loves us, even when his silence remains incomprehensible. And the context of this quotation revealed that the Pope wished to emphasize that when a human being spoke about God, there was more that could not be said than that could be said. It was precisely this that Eberhard Jüngel believed to be problematic in his reflection on the same phrase in Sermo 117. Jüngel believed that it could not be ruled out that this resignation to the incomprehensibility of God for human beings would be detrimental to thinking about God and to human action. It was a great problem for him that Augustine contributed to the fact that God, wegen seiner schlechthinigen Jenseitigkeit und Überlegenkeit, weder von der Sprache ergriffen noch vom Denken begriffen werden kann. It was a problem, this apophatic approach for Jüngel. Benedict XVI, however, had no such misgivings, and in fact made it difficult for himself to speak confidently about God, just as Augustine had done. Moreover, he undermined the discourse of those who used far too specific images of God to make dogmatic assertions of faith, or descended into particularism or fundamentalism. On the contrary, by acknowledging that when one grasped something, it was not God, a critical awareness was developed that was inherent in the conceptualization of the Christian faith. So now I come to a conclusion. On the one hand, Sermo 117 was a sermon in which Augustine, the boundaries between orthodoxy and heterodoxy, they were clearly drawn through this principle of comparatio. On the other hand, it was also clear that it contained an appreciation of heterodox ways of discourse about God. In fact, in this sermon, he contended that heterodox discourse about a certain aspect of the Trinity was even more elucidating than orthodox discourse about the same subject. Above all, Augustine's insight that it was better to remain silent about God contributed to a much milder tone than the principle of comparison that permeated his early work. Augustine nevertheless refused to resign himself to the notion that God was so mysterious as to preclude the possibility of saying anything about him at all. He admittedly acknowledged in Sermo 117 that he preferred to remain silent about God, and his awareness of the incomprehensibility and the ineffability of God even led him to credit an image derived from Arianism with some significance. On closer inspection, Augustine in fact presupposed the negation of any claim to knowledge of God as a precondition for credible propositional discourse about him. Sermo 117 also proved that Augustine did not weaken apophatic theology by making dogmatic assertions. The opposite, in fact, was quite true. In this sermon, he showed especially that affirmative and negative discourse about God were inextricably linked with each other and, as such, greatly added to each other's value. In fact, in Sermo 117, he expanded on the difficulties that resulted from speaking affirmatively about God. It is perhaps possible to infer, too, that Augustine did not really believe that the Arians were a threat to the unity of the Church, of the Cattolica. According to Augustine, heretics and schismatics had converted to the status of superstitio, which was diametrically opposed to the status of religio, because they lacked in particular the unity of doctrine and sacraments that was characterized the Cattolica. And the old Augustine stated that though they were born of the Church and were thus daughters of the Church, they were bad daughters of the Church. But seeing that the Arians in his times no longer posed a threat of schism, he made use of their statements. If the heresy was likely to have led to an actual schism, I think, as he believed was the case with Pelagianism, his tone would have probably been more decisive. As soon as the unity of church was at stake, he was much more reluctant to emphasize the incomprehensibility of God. And the measure in which Augustine emphasized God's incomprehensibility appears to have depended on the measure in which he believed that the unity of the church was at peril. So, my final conclusion. The reading of Augustine's works acquires new brilliance when they are viewed in the light of his growing reticence or uncertainty. It is true to say for him that apophasis, negative speaking about God, formed the heart of his theology. It's an anachronism, theology, but anyway. Whenever the fact is forgotten that his treatment of the great theological themes he addressed was accompanied by caveats about the relativity of such discourse, its essential tenure is obscured. Every attempt to speak thematically about God was in fact an attempt to remain silent about him and to be silent to him. Augustine gave no final answer to the question as to who God is. Nevertheless, his faith in God as unknowable but near in Christ provides a clear direction and perspective to his thinking. This present paper has aspired to uphold the investigative and preliminary character of Augustine's writings against the certainty of his interpreters, who, in papers such as this one, have not hesitated to present even his uncertainty as a tenet of a dogma. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Heath, for an absolutely splendid, very clear and provocative lecture. Now, as we usually do in the Philosophy Society, now is the time for you to ask questions, make comments, raise objections, and Professor Heath will try to answer all your doubts or clarify all your doubts.
With the emphasis on trying.
Professor Van Heath, thank you very much for your lecture. What difference would your presentation of the unknowability of God, how much would it differ from the Gnostic exegesis, from the Gnostic affirmation that nothing could be said positively about God, okay. Gnosticism?
Yeah. Well, thank you for this fine question. So, the approach of God in the Augustine way, I'm inclined to say, differs from the Gnostic approach. Like I explained a little bit in the lecture this morning, it differs from it because he puts emphasis on the necessity of, well, living with all your senses. So sensory perception in discovering God is necessary. What I explained this morning was that we cannot know God with our senses, but to become aware of God, you must have had some experiences of beautiful colors, of beautiful smell, of being loved. And it is not the same. So God is not a color, and God is not a beautiful. It's not an embrace, but in order to be become sensible for the divine being here on earth, one must have been smelled, one must be, and that's the difference with the Gnostic. The Gnostics, they do not appreciate the sensory perception on their way to God. And Augustine, he postulates the personality as a whole person with body and spirit. So we need the sensory perception, we need our body, we need our spirit, we need our intellectual movements in order to be able to grasp in a way God, although God cannot be grasped wholly.
I wonder whether one can put it this way. On our side, we cannot comprehend God, because yes, God is a mystery. But on the other side, we can let ourselves be comprehended by God.
Yes, exactly.
So there is this sort of dialectic which you have tried to bring out, isn't it? Because the inability that we have in talking about God, as you have been explaining, is a condition for us to listen to the Word. And listening to the Word, of course, implies listening to the Word as a meaningful Word. So there is some kind of possibility, isn't it, of talking about God on the basis of His Word.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. So that's the reason why even in this Sermo 117, Augustine simply states that, well, if we cannot know God, we must look upon Christ. And we can discern then that God is with us, that we are loved by God. Otherwise, God wouldn't have humiliated himself, a little bit in the Neoplatonic way, by becoming a man. So in the incarnation, Augustine sees quite clearly, even in this sermo, that, well, we know that we are, as a humankind as a whole, are loved by God, and that we can know God as humble. And if we want to know who God really is, we must be humble like Christ. And that's a road, a way of approaching God in which we can grasp God better than with all kinds, says Augustine, of intellectual exercises, just by being humble as an attitude of life. That's, but within this context of the incomprehensibility of his divine being and activity, as it were. Is that an answer to your question, more or less?
What I was trying to say was whether one can articulate your argument in these words, namely that we are unable to talk about God,
yes,
to grasp God. But this is only a condition. I mean, this is what you have been saying yourself.
Yes.
This is only a condition for accepting ourselves to be comprehended by God.
Yes.
And comprehended by God as a loving reality.
Sorry?
As a loving reality.
Yes.
Love.
Yes. Well, I think the one doesn't exclude, doesn't just that this way of thinking, Augustine doesn't elaborate in this Sermo 117. There is, however, if we consider his approach of the Bible, he says, well, in the Bible we can know what God wants us to be. And that's exactly what you were saying, that we must or we can trust on the fact that we are comprehended by God. That's correct. On the other hand, he considers the Bible to be lac parvuli, milk for the little ones. We cannot endure, we cannot bear solid food. So God adapts himself to be comprehended to the measure or to our stage of our development. And we are like little children in our spiritual development or in our capability to grasp God. We are like little children, and therefore the Bible is like milk for the little ones. So God does not reveal his whole essence in the Bible, although I admit that he shows himself, he wants to self, himself to be comprehended by us, but on a very initial stage of, well, development, I would say.
The subtitle, in the subtitle of your of your lecture, you spoke about the merging of orthodoxy and heterodoxy.
Yes.
Even though in the printed version that I was given, that last phrase, heterodoxy, was left out. So I was wondering what the merging of orthodoxy meant. But now I know.
Okay, well, the merging means that Augustine appreciates, like I tried to explain a little bit in my paper, that he appreciates some approaches in the Arian way of considering God.
Right, no, no, that's fine. But I was saying it's the merging of orthodoxy with something else that you were talking about.
Yeah, with heterodoxy.
Excellent, yes. Excellent. But that was left out from the title I was given, the printed title I was given and distributed to us. But anyway, you clarified that in your talk. No, but my question wasn't about that. Would you think that in the attitude of believers towards non-believers, we could learn something from Augustine's approach or attitude towards God and his incomprehensibility? In other words, do you feel that believers tend to talk too much about God when they're talking to non-believers? To say too much about God?
That's a typical Dutch question, by the way. So believers are always blamed that we frame God in our words, in our dogmas. And what I try to expose to my explain to my students in Holland, and like you said on the radio as well, I'm happy they are broadcasting me sometimes, is that although we can speak about God, according to Augustine, we always must be aware that we cannot explain God completely, but we, following Augustine as believers, I prefer, I would say, as a believer, to pray to God, and not to only to speak about God. It's Augustine prefers this. Praying too, as well, like he does in the Confessionis. But we cannot keep silent, because if we keep silent, then then the secret of God will be so secret that we do not even know that there is a secret anymore. So we are always in this tension between the preferring silence and contemplate the very essence of God, as good as it gets, and speaking about God. But we must speak, because if we do not speak or explain to students or whoever, well, the secret of God remains dead a secret. It's a kind of aporia, that we do not even know that there is a secret anymore. And then the rest is a very infertile silence.
And my mind, because there doesn't seem to be any other question from the audience. Do you think that there is something of this attitude of being silent about God in Eastern religions like Buddhism?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The reason why people in Holland, for example, prefer the Buddhist approach, or even prefer the Eastern Orthodox approach, so what you see is a kind of, increasing number of people who go to the Russian Orthodox Church because they believe that in these tradition people only remain silent about God, and that's the way to proceed to God. And in this postmodern area, people blame the official churches of being too cataphatic, too affirmative about God in talking about God. And what I try to prove is that the church fathers who are blamed for being too cataphatic, they are not that cataphatic at all. They are more apophatic than people in the East are inclined to think. So that's my mission.
I'm wondering if you haven't shortchanged God a bit. I'm wondering if God isn't interested in being more comprehensible than perhaps you're willing to allow, because, you know, according to Hegel's views on the phenomenology of mind, the sense certainty is the first moment of the dialectic. And although I don't want to resort to Hegel as an authority on God, he certainly makes God a lot more communicable than I think Augustine does. And so to come back to Father Grima's point, you know, I think that Father, that our dear Lord is a lot more in touch with us through our rationality and through the dialectic of history and through the growth and maturation of consciousness in moving from individualism to communalism mm-hmm. and back to individualism, which enriches our sense of Him. Our knowledge of God today is, as you know, as you're pointing out, far richer than it was in the time of Augustine.
Oh, absolutely. But I understand the importance of your question. So our knowledge is increasing, and that's a way of considering the results of our human thinking. It's a result on which Augustine had reflections as well. He says the more answers we develop, the more intuitions we receive, the more we approach the very essence of God in itself, the more questions will be raised. And the more we get an introspection in ourselves, the more we know about a human being as such, the more questions will raise, as for human being, as for the very essence of God. And therefore he ends up a part of the Confessions, where he has made his travel towards his interiority. He ends up with a beautiful saying, "Questio mihi factus sum." I still remain myself a question. And that goes almost in the same words, he ends his De Trinitate. There he says, well, I tried to analyze the essence of God. I tried to do research in all the Greek fathers, etc., etc. But I have more attempted than I have reached. And, well, I would say that this is a kind of a paradigmatic saying for all scholars in theology or philosophy. The more solutions the more conclusions we can draw, the more questions that's the Augustinian way of thinking, of course. The more conclusions we draw, the more questions we will develop from these conclusions. It's kind of the Hydra of Lerna. You cut one head of this Hydra and two others come up in the Greek mythology.
I must once again thank Professor Van Heest, not just for his lecture, but also for the way he answered our questions. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to the 14th Annual St. Augustine Lecture 2010 entitled Augustine's Evaluation of Fear and Its Reception. This talk was delivered by Professor Paul Van Geest.